Great. So, okay. The system is contributing, or the employer, the city, I should say, is contributing on statutory contribution rates. So you're not actually contributing the actual determined contribution, but it's included in the plan, and we value, kind of look at the plan status from year to year. We prepare projections aside from evaluation to determine whether the plan is projected to be fully funded if all things, all the assumptions are met. We prepare accounting standards. Government Accounting Standards Board has statements 67 and 68. We prepare disclosures for every year for the fund's financial statements and for the city's financial statements. We do experience studies like this where we look at all the assumptions on a five-year basis to determine what needs updating. And any other projections or benefit studies that the system needs, that's what we do as actuaries for the fund. So what we're going to go through today is a five-year experience study. This is the first thing really we did for the system when we took over in 2016. We did an experience study. And the purpose on page, I guess you can go to page two, please. Well, the next page of this line. I'm sorry, page after that. Skip the agenda to the next page. Thank you. So the purpose of an experience study is we're doing a deep dive of the assumptions used to value the fund. This is important because we want to try to appropriately value the benefits currently being paid and due to members in the future. We look at all the assumptions that are being used in the actuarial methods. We look at the demographic assumptions, which we'll go over in a second, and the economic assumptions. And we come up with a set of recommended assumptions that we'll present today that we feel will be an appropriate measure of the fund's value. We look at what's happened over the past several years. We look at the assumptions, the trends, what's expected to happen in the future. And as you know, there's been a lot that's happened over the last few years with the plan changes in 2017 specifically. So there's a bit of an art as well as a science to setting assumptions because we can't fully set assumptions based on what happened in the past because it's been an anomalous situation in 2016 and 2017. So we look at that, but we don't fully set assumptions just based on past experience. We set them based on what's happened and what's expected to happen in the future. We try to avoid any unnecessary, contribution and accounting volatility, really accounting volatility in your case, because there are statutory contribution rates. An experience study does meet industry standards, and it's a government finance officers association best practice. And also, as trustees, you're fiduciaries of this fund, and you have a fiduciary responsibility, and this is part of meeting your responsibility is to do an experience study. So on the next page, please, I've already talked through a little bit of this. We did, like I said, one of the first things we did was a study for the period 2010 through 2014, and those were first implemented in 2016 valuation due to the timing change and the change in actuaries. Often you'll change your assumptions and put them in place with the valuation concurrent with the study, which is what we're proposing today. There are ASOPs, actuarial standards of practice, we rely on in setting assumptions. And each assumption needs to be the actuary's best estimate, not just in aggregate, a set of assumptions that are best estimate, but each assumption needs to be something we think is reasonable for the fund. And the assumptions here will apply to both the combined and supplemental plans. And as the Board of Trustees, you have the authority for setting the assumptions. That's something the public sector, the actuary, does not fully control or really does not control. For like a Taft-Hartley or a union plan, we can set the assumptions and say this is what they're going to be, period. We don't usually do it in that manner, but we have the authority to set the assumption. But for a public sector pension plan, the Board of Trustees has the ultimate say in what assumptions are used in the valuation. So you can adopt all the assumptions, which none of the assumptions, you can go on business as usual, which is not what we would recommend, but you do have the final say. On the next page, page four, we've pretty much gone through that already. Let's go ahead and skip to page five, please. So these are the assumptions we looked at in the experience study, and we look at this on a year-to-year basis as well, but we do more of a deeper dive every 5 years. So on the demographic side, we're looking at mortality, which is, you know, death of active members, retirees, beneficiaries, and disabled beneficiaries. We look at rates of withdrawal, disability, retirement, both for the drop and non-drop retirements, and the percent married and spousal age difference for those who are retiring. On the economic side, we look through inflation and discount rates, salary increases, you know, payroll growth, admin expenses, COLA, and then whether the drop in immunization rate needs to change. And then there's actuarial methods we look at as well, which we're not recommending any changes to your actuarial methods. On page 6 and 7, I'm not going to read through all these, just needless to say. On page 6, these are the changes that were put into place in your last experience study. And usually you'll see a whole, not every assumption changes with every experience study, but usually there's a wholesale change in assumptions, and that's what we have here today. Most of the assumptions we're recommending to change, and that's because patterns change over time. Trends change, retirement and turnover experience changes, the salaries scale gets updated with the meet confer agreements, you know, investment portfolios change, so your expected rates of return change over time. There's obviously been changes in the market recently. And as a quick backup, the experience study today does not contemplate what's happened with the COVID crisis or pandemic in the last couple months. This is period January 1, 2015 through December 31st, 2019. We'll do projections when we do the valuation, and we'll receive some input from the system at that time based on short-term rates of return. But as far as setting the assumptions, the COVID pandemic is not part of the assumption setting right now. We did not completely disregard that, but the bulk of this work had been worked on and completed prior to everything going crazy. On page 7 here, there have been plenty of changes even after the last experience study, primarily in 2017 as a result of the plan changes that went into effect September 1, 2017. And the September 1, 2017 plan changes and assumption changes were valued in the 1/1/17 valuation since we knew about them, and that was going to affect the fund ongoing. We did include those in the 2017 valuation. And a couple minor assumption changes have been included in 2018 and 2019. On page 8, just the gains and losses, big picture gains and losses of the last 5 years. You know, there have been some, actually after, it's interesting, after 2015, there's a write-down of assets, I think at 12/31, and the asset experience on a market basis has been fairly close. Well, maybe not quite fairly close, but the losses as a result of that were not as large as some of the demographic losses. Another demographic losses, which, when I say demographic, I'm talking about the non-investment. You have investment losses, and then everything else, which is primarily the demographics, which means people retiring or quitting or dying other than expected. Usually we hope to keep those within 1 to 1.5% range if possible. 1% and below is ideal, but none of your non-investment losses have been dramatic over the past 5 years, even with the plan changes and the heavy rates of retirement turnover in 2016 and 17. On page 9, it's just a big picture summary, and we'll go through the dollar amounts in a couple minutes. So one thing, the first bullet point is important. The preliminary, the market value of assets we're using, the asset values are not final. It's not what we expect to use in the valuation. If it's decided that the assets won't be ready in time, so there's a couple investments are always a little later giving you their values. So if that's not ready and these numbers is decided to use these assets, then what you see here would be the final results of your valuation. That's not expected to happen. If it does not happen, then the results here will change. But regardless of whether the assets change or not, the assumption changes are really primarily focused on the demographic side. So the relative scope of the changes due to the recommended assumptions will be the same. Dollar amounts may change if the assets change, but the relative scope will remain the same. In 2017, obviously, there were some major plan changes, and in 2016 and 17, kind of the run-up to those, there was a lot greater turnover and retirement experience than expected. You know, there was the drop run on the bank, and there's a lot of retirements, and that kind of made valuing or setting assumptions a little bit difficult for the retirement and turnover experience, because there's a lot greater retirements in 2016 and 17 expected, but then there were less in 2018 and 2019 because those who wanted to leave left. So retirement turnover has been up and down during this five-year period. In total, your mortality experience, though, was pretty close to expected. We were pretty pleased on that note that your mortality tables were working pretty well with expectations. So that bullet point in the middle of the page, prior to any changes, any assumption or method changes, your 2020 valuation results would show an increase of about 2.85% in the actuarial liability, and that's par for the course. There's nothing unusual about that. We expect it to go up every year. There would be a 9.58% increase in the total normal cost, and we'll talk in a few minutes more about the component pieces and what the normal cost is. That's a little bit higher than expected, but, well, normally it's a little bit higher than expected, but there was an increase in active participants, but more to the point, though, there was the salary increases. There were some multiple step increases for bulk of the population. So total payroll went up almost 9%, average payroll over 6.25%, so those directly impact the normal cost, so that's why that increase is a little bit larger than usual. And then your actuarial determined contribution would have gone up 5.6% or $8.6 million. And we'll go into more detail, like I said, in a few minutes about what these individual components mean. So if all of the assumption method changes that are recommended or adopted before any discount rate changes, that's a separate item, then the liability would increase by 1.69% and the normal cost just under 4%. And that's not for experience study, that's not bad at all. There's usually the cost increase with the experience study. We're trying to set the cost based, like I said, on what's happened, what's expected to happen. As trends change, that usually leads to an increase in cost. Not always. It has happened where we'll see decreases in the liability with experience studies, but that's a little more unusual. Small increases like this are more par for the course. So currently you have a 2.75% payroll growth assumption. And if you drop that to 2.5%, there is going to be an additional increase to the liability, not to the liability, excuse me, but to the actuarial determined contribution. And we'll talk about why in a moment. So the 2019 valuation, the actuarial determined contribution was just over $152 million. Preliminarily in 2020, prior to any changes, it'd be just under $161 million. And with all the recommended assumption changes prior to any discount rate changes, you're just under $172 million. Now, we valued all these changes at your current 7.25% return assumption, along with 7%, 6.75%, and 6.5%. I know there have been talk over the past year or so of the discount rate and what's appropriate, and you're actually right there in the range of public sector universe. You're right at the median rate right now, but we wanted to show some different ranges, and you don't have to make changes on a quarter point basis, but that's the most common. You don't have to do that, but if you made a change that was less than a quarter point, you can see the endpoints. So we did quarter point drops down to 6.5. Each 25 point basis drop, you can see approximately a range of $124 to $136 million increase in the liability, normal cost 4.1 to 4.8 million, and the total actuarially determined contribution in the 7.4 to 8.1 million dollar range.
Jeff, one quick question: is the actuarially determined contribution both employee and employer, or just employee?
The actuarial determined contribution is employer. The expected employee contributions are already taken into account when we determine the employer's normal cost. on page a couple pages we'll go into that in more detail. But that,
Jeff, before
that,
you
yeah,
go on,
I'm sorry,
Jeff. This is Kelly.
Yes.
Before you go on to the next page, can I add a comment? I don't know if you have any more on this page before I do.
No, that's fine. Please.
Okay. So what I wanted to do is just reemphasize what Jeff said about this first bullet and basically all the results that are in, that he'll show you today in this experience study. And these findings are based on a preliminary asset value that I gave to Jeff and Caitlin to do for this study. And I want to tell you what's in that number and what isn't in that number, because I'm sure when you see the valuation, the numbers are going to be different than what you see today. So I gave them this number about 2 weeks ago, maybe a week and a half. Well, probably 2 weeks ago. And what it included was all of the market values for all of the public assets, because, of course, we know those, and all of the 1231 market value of the private assets that we had reporting for at the time. What it didn't include, of course, is Huff, Lone Star, which, you know, those two assets, especially Huff, year to year have significant volatility up and down. So you can see, we could see a significant change there. It also didn't include AEW's 1231 numbers, but I don't anticipate a big change there. So I don't want you to be surprised when you see the valuation in a couple of months. That the numbers will be different from this, but we needed to have kind of a baseline to show you the results of the study. So I just wanted to emphasize that piece.
Okay. If we want to move to the next couple pages, I'm not going to go through these one by one. Caitlin's going to discuss the demographic changes in a few minutes. Just to say, on these two pages, you'll see mostly there are proposed changes. We're not recommending changes to disability rates. They're right on target, and you have a surprisingly low number of disabilities for a police and fire system. The drop utilization, we're not recommending a change in that. What that is we're assuming no new members enter the drop. We know that there are some that are, and that's primarily those who have reached their maximum service benefit. But there's not enough to make an impact right now, and if those numbers continue, we'll look at that in the future. On the next page, again, almost everything has a recommended change. The percent married and spousal age difference, that's those who are percent married and those the age difference upon retirement, not just for active employees. We're not recommending changes there. And then the admin expenses, we're relying on feedback from Kelly and the system on that. So everything else, really, we're recommending some tweaks. Some of them are larger changes, some of them are smaller. But this is not uncommon to have a large set of assumption changes in an experience study. So let's go two pages forward. Let's go to what everybody cares about, the numbers. And we'll provide some background for this in a couple minutes. We'll go through why we recommended what changes we did, but we figured we'd just cut to the chase up front. You can see the total recommended contribution, or the actuarial determined contribution, that's comprised of the employer normal cost and a payment on the unfunded liability. So the normal cost, I know I've mentioned that a few times, with actuarial funding methods, well, first of all, when we're doing a valuation, we determine a present value of future benefits, which is the benefits currently payable to those in pay status and what's been accrued to date for active employees and what they're expected to earn in the future. And depending on your funding method is how you allocate the present value of benefits to the past and to the future. So the portion allocated to the past is the actuarial accrued liability, and the portion allocated to the future is the present value of future normal cost. And the normal cost is the slice of that present value of what's to be earned in the future that's allocated to the current year. So the normal cost really is with your funding method, the traditional entry age, you're doing your normal cost and a little percent of pay. So basically, if the percent of pay for a member, or if this percent of pay was contributed over their working lifetime from when they enter the plan to when they're assumed to exit, that would fully fund their benefit. So that's essentially it's the cost of the plan each year. That's that year's cost of the pension plan. It's kind of a simplified way of saying that. So that's what the normal cost is. And the total normal cost is calculated. The normal cost for every member is determined, and it's summed up. So you have the total normal cost, and then we add an administrative expense assumption because there are admin expenses that have to be paid. And we subtract out the employee's expected contributions. So, Bill, going back to your question, we were talking total normal cost earlier, but in the actuarial determined contribution, it's the employer's portion, net of what's expected to be paid by the employees. The employees are paying 13.5%. So we determine the total cost, we add the admin expenses, we subtract out the employee's expected contributions, that comes up with an employer normal cost. So the employer normal cost plus the amortization of the unfunded liability, that's added together. There's an interest factor applied because it's really for the following year. And then that's what the actuarially determined contribution is. So I think on this page, item 6 and then at the bottom 9 and 10 are probably what's most relevant. I mean, the liability, there's liability increases and there's normal cost increases. But the recommended contribution, that's kind of a metric to look at compared to what the city is actually paying based on statutory rates. So the 2019 valuation, the contribution was $152 million. Preliminarily in this valuation, $160.7 million, with a slight drop in the funded ratio on an actuarial value basis from 48.1 to 46.74. And just a quick, I guess, side note for the newer board members, if you're not familiar, the market value of assets, of course, is your asset value. That's what's what you're getting each year from your investing folks, and that's the value of your assets and money you have on hand. The actuarial value of assets is a 5-year smooth asset number. We're recognizing gains and losses over a 5-year period. And recognize them at 20% per year. And the purpose of that is that, you know, this is a snapshot. An actual evaluation is a snapshot as of one day in time. And when you see wild fluctuations in the market, as we've certainly seen, and we saw in December of 2018, that's a good example. Market was going okay, and in 2018, everything went nuts in December. Ended up with a big drop. So instead of recognizing that whole loss for the year immediately, we recognize 20% that year and then 20% each of the next 4 years. And the idea is to have more of a smooth asset value. This is a long-term proposition. You don't have to capture the entire loss at one time. On the flip side, though, you're not capturing the entire gain at one time when you have asset gains. So we're smoothing out over a 5-year period, and this is pretty standard in the actuarial world and public sector pension plans. Almost every plan of any size uses a smooth asset method of some sort. When you're using a 5-year method, straight line amortization, market gains and losses is the most common. So I just wanted to go over that real quick while there's different funded ratios. So the 2020 preliminary results, like I said, was $160.7 million. Once we add the recommended demographic and salary scale changes, it goes to $167.3 million. Now, we're recommending lowering the payroll growth and inflation assumptions. Those don't have to be the same. They usually are. From 2.75, it's a little bit on the high side, or starting to become on the high side, down to 2.5. And that does have an impact on the recommended contribution. It does not impact the normal cost or the liability, but it impacts how you're amortizing the unfunded liability. So in doing that, that increases to $171.6 million. And those are all 7.25%. all of the black column headers, those are your current discount rate of 7.25. And then the three to the right, we show the results at 7%, 6.75%, and 6.5%. And, you know, you going from the 7.25 to 7, well, each one is about $8 to $9 million, or about 7.4 to $8.1 million. So you're not contributing based on this total recommended contribution, but this would impact obviously the liabilities and the normal costs and your funded percentage and what gets included in your GASB disclosures and financial statements. So there's a bunch of things to consider about what's appropriate, and we'll get to that in a couple minutes. Are there any questions so far? I know I've just been kind of going on and on. Please jump in if there are any.
We're good.
Okay. Well, let's skip then a couple pages to 15 and start going through some of the demographic changes.
All right. So I'm going to lead you through most of the demographic assumptions. Kind of what we found, what the current assumptions are, and what our new proposed assumptions are. As Jeff said, feel free to jump in anytime with questions. The first one is kind of one of the main assumptions, that's the mortality. This is used to project the expected lifetime of participants and, you know, kind of determines how long we anticipate benefits to be paid for. The current tables were published in 2014 by the Society of Actuaries. They were kind of the latest and greatest when they came out, but the experience used to develop these tables was primarily private retirement plans in the United States. So kind of what I'll get to a little later is the Society of Actuaries did not come out with new tables that are public specific. We have three different groups. We've got, you know, pre-retirement rates, you know, people still working have lower expected mortality, and then post-retirement, once you've retired, a little bit higher because you're in older ages. And then a disabled life table. I'm going to jump to the next slide. I'll run through some of our findings over the five-year period. So as I said, post-retirement mortality, this is split into two main groups, too. We kind of had retirees, and that's mainly a male population. And then on the other hand was your beneficiaries, your surviving spouses, and that's mainly female. This is post-retirement mortality is the most important of the three groups, just because this is where determining, like I said, the duration over which your benefits are paid. For the male retiree group, over the five-year period, our actual experience was right in line with expected with the 368 deaths. I think Jeff had said earlier that we're pretty pleased with how that number turned out mortality-wise. So although the current tables used were developed using a private experience, they actually align pretty closely with your experience. Beneficiaries is a little bit of a different story. You had 168 beneficiary deaths compared to 215 expected. So a little fewer, so a bit fewer actual than expected on that side. To a lesser extent, your disabled life mortality and pre-retirement mortality, actual deaths were greater than expected over the five-year period. So in total, though, you kind of looked at the full group over 5 years. Our actual to expected wasn't too far off, although you had some differences amongst the groups. Let's go to the next slide. This is kind of just a page discussing the newer tables. So whereas, as I mentioned, the 2014 tables that the Society Actuaries put out, in 2019 of last year, they put out some newer tables that are called the PUB 2010 tables, and they use solely public sector pension plan experience. And they also broke down tables, so there's different groups for general employees, teachers, and public safety. So if you want to go to the next page, we're actually recommending moving to the new PUB 2010 tables that are specific to the public safety employees. And then amongst the different groups, we have slight adjustments that we put in there, either a set back or set forward. What this means is basically we're shifting it, whereas there's a retirement age or a mortality rate at each age. We're either going to shift that back or forward, meaning we'll take the mortality rate at age 50 and apply it to someone who's 51 or apply it to someone who's 49 or vice versa. We kind of determine those setbacks and step forwards by taking these newer tables and comparing them to the actual, you know, by age experience for everybody over the past 5 years. Go to the next page. Just some graphs to show, you know, what this really means. As you can see, the actual rates can be, you know, quite volatile just because your experience is not always as smooth as the assumption. But you see that there, the male retiree table, the green and blue lines are pretty close. That's our current to proposed rate. As I'd mentioned, the experience there was in line. So although we wanted to move to the updated public safety specific tables, we didn't want too big of a change because your old table was in line with experience. So although there's a slight adjustment there, that new table is pretty close to your current table. Beneficiaries, as I had mentioned, the actual number of deaths was much lower than expected. So you can see that blue line there on the right side is a little lower. We're assuming less mortality among the beneficiary group, kind of more consistent with your experience.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
This is Gilbert Garcia, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but when you look at these new tables, there was some discussion in the past about public safety employees having a higher mortality rate, things of that nature, than just general city workers. Is there any truth to that in these numbers? That's number one. And number two, when we did a reset on the drop, et cetera, we used 85 as a, I don't know the right word, termination age. Does this change that?
Do you mind if I jump in here for a second, Caitlin?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Please, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, Gilbert, and I don't have it up in front of me now, but I think we presented something to the board sometime in the past year specifically related to your question, because I know that's a question we've gotten a lot from fire and police over the years. And the answer is no, there's not a demonstrable difference in life expectancy once retirement occurs. You know, for active employees, there's no question public safety has a greater mortality experience than the general population. But once they retire, once your employees retire and police and fire retire, expected lifetime is pretty close. There's not a significant difference. And there's several reasons behind that. For one, the physical and mental stress is, I'm not saying it's gone, I'm just saying, but they're not doing the same physical labor as they were as active employees. Plus, police and fire tend to retire at younger ages than the general population. So over time, and I'm not a doctor, I can't go into all the details, but basically the answer is no, there's not a demonstrable difference between life expectancy for a general employee retiree and a police or fire retiree. And as far as the drop annuitization, Kelly asked me that yesterday, and I looked into that, and I'll give you an answer couched in the fact that this is not, don't consider this final because I put this together myself and it's not been reviewed yet. But based on these different tables, 85 wasn't really the termination age. It's just that 30 years was kind of the longest period we were doing this over, and the bulk of the populations were happening around age 55, or the bulk of retirement, excuse me, were happening around age 55. So it kind of came out to 85, ended up being the life expectancy. But so there's not a big change in this for retirees with the new tables. The younger retirement ages, well, you don't have usually people retiring under age 50, but you know, so the younger the age, the bigger the difference in as far as the expected lifetime. But once you get to age 50 and older, the expected lifetime is within a year at all the ages. So some of the ages, we have a expected lifetime of 1 year older. Some of the ages, there's no difference. The older you get, the less the difference becomes. So really, there's at most there'd be a 1 year age difference for the bulk of the drop annuities.
So I apologize. As a layman, there was a basis for using 85. Now that we have this new data, are you saying, hold on one second, there was a basis for use 85 because we had a big, you and I in particular had a big discussion about it, right? So,
right.
You remember?
Yeah.
I remember. Okay.
Yeah.
And so there was a basis for 85, and for the new trustees, what we're talking about is if the retirees had money in drop, they used a particular age, which was 85, as their, for lack of a better word, termination age. So they took their age to 85, and whatever they had their drop, they just divided it by that many years, and then there's a interest rate growth in there. And so that's why that age is so important. And I'm not trying to open up wounds, but I just know retirees are going to ask the question, so we just need to have the answer, which is there was a basis for 85, and now that we're looking at some sort of updated table or something, does it change that basis using the same whatever we use to get to 85? And if the answer is it changes by about a year, we just need to know, is it a year shorter or a year longer? And we just need to know that answer.
Right. It's not that – okay. It's not that we take it out to 85 and then divide it. It's based on the expected lifetime when they retire, and on average it was about 85. So that's a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm trying to break it down to a reasonable sense. That's all.
Right. And you're that's essentially what you're saying. Yes.
That's right.
And the answer is that for the bulk of the new drop annuitant, it would be expected to be, if it was 85 last time, it would expect to be 86 this time.
Okay. That's all I needed. Again, I'm not trying to open up or retrade anything at all. We just need to know, because that will be on the, you know, that'll be a question, and we just need to be able to know. So I appreciate it.
Right. But those who are current drop annuitants, I mean, theirs isn't going to change. This is for new drop annuitants.
Understood. But everyone always will just make a comparison, that's all.
Right. So, yeah.
It's a natural thing for people to do, right? Especially
right.
If the movement's only a year, it's less important. But if the movement had been much bigger, then there'd be a lot more questions. So that's all.
Right. Yeah, understood. And if they retire at a later age, there may not be a difference. But you're not going to have many retirements past the point where there's no difference for the most part. If it was 85 last time, it would be 86 this time. Essentially.
Thank you. Okay, I don't want to use a lot of time. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, if there are no more questions on this page, I'm just going to jump to the next slide. And this is kind of the other piece to mortality is mortality improvement. Basically, the assumption that people born in later years will be living longer. Obviously, if you have two plan participants, somebody born in 1945 is going to have a very different expected lifetime as someone born in 1970 or even later in 1990 if you have a brand new employee. So the actuarial standards of practice require provision to allow for improvements in mortality. And this is actually, we had been using an MP 2015 projection scale. And the MP improvement scales are put out by the Society of Actuaries annually. They look at nationwide experience and have been updating them each year. In general, the expectation for longevity has come down. I think the first time this scale came out in 2014, it was kind of projecting much more optimistic longevity in the population. It's kind of been scaled back each year. So we're going to recommend using the latest iteration of that improvement scale, and that would be the MP 2019 scale. And then that's all I had for mortality. I'm going to jump ahead. The next assumption I'm going to go through is turnover or withdrawal, and this is the assumption that an active participant is going to leave employment before retiring. Our current assumptions are service-based, basically assuming that newer employees will be more likely to leave employment than somebody with 15, 20 years of service. We've got different rates for based on police and fire, and we don't assume any termination or turnover for participants in the drop, and we also don't assume any turnover once somebody reaches normal retirement age. this was another one of the assumptions, as Jeff had mentioned, that the five-year period where we were looking at was volatile. And for both groups, the actual number of turnover during that period was almost double what we were assuming, with particularly high numbers during 2016 and 2017 that skewed the overall results. Another piece of our turnover assumption is what benefit people will take when they leave employment, whether they'll take a cash out or they'll actually wait until normal retirement age and collect a deferred annuity. We're currently assuming that they take the greater of the two on an actuarial basis. And the refund assumption has a limited impact because we are assuming that they'll take the greater of the two. But due to the low turnover as a whole is low, so it's not a huge piece of the assumption. You go to the next page, just to talk about what our recommendations are here. On the right there, you'll see our different current and proposed rates. Fire is in red, police is in blue. We recommend maintaining that service-based format. And for both groups, we're going to lower the ultimate year of assumed turnover from 38 to 25 years. For fire, we're increasing the rates for almost the entire period. Police, too, we're increasing for the first 15 years. And we also are maintaining the assumption that terminated participants elect annuity or refund based on the greater. Actually, I'll touch on that more specific, what our, once somebody leaves employment, what their retirement assumptions are. The next two slides then are just graphs showing our current versus proposed rates. This one's for fire here. The kind of green teal line at the bottom, that's our expected rate during the five-year period. That was based on our current assumption. That red is the actual. As you can see, it's much higher. So our new rates just kind of try and smooth that actual experience at the higher level. And then the next slide is police, and similar story there, that we're just slightly increasing those rates to try and better align with that orange line, which is the actual experience that we saw over the five-year period. Both these graphs only show 20 years. There was more experience beyond that, but it was very small, so we chose to focus on kind of the main pieces, although you do have some people who will work for 20 years and then leave without retiring. Most of your turnover is coming from their earlier ages, as you can see here.
Does this increase?
Okay, what was that last comment? That most of the turnover was happening where again?
In the earlier years. Most employees, if they're going to leave, they leave, you know, within the first 1, 2, 5 years, and that's why we have the much higher rate there. That's why the kind of the line is much higher there. It goes down.
But right now, like with the plan, as the, you know, well, pre-COVID and pre-energy situation, there was more growing comfort with the longevity of the pension, and there was also this also reflects the varying competitive nature of Dallas salaries versus surrounding areas, and that's been corrected. So wouldn't it just normalize? I mean, like, the proposed rate, if we did nothing, then with those two factors, it would go back to expected rate, we would assume?
Possibly.
Yeah.
I don't understand the turnover discussion. Like, I mean, like, and what is the proposed rate? Like, what? Like, the significance?
Well, a certain number of people are expected to quit every year, and that you don't want to maintain liability for someone who's left or is expected to leave. So we know there's a certain percentage of folks that are going to quit every year. A certain percentage will retire. They'll pass away. They'll become disabled. And this is one of the assumptions that goes into valuing the plan, which is also why we look at assumptions every few years and make changes based on what's happened and what's expected to happen. When we looked at the rate, we primarily set the rates based on what happened in 18 and 19, just because 16 and 17 were so volatile. And we are aware that the salary scales salaries have been increased and rates have changed, and those are accounted for in the salary scale. But it's too early to say what's going to happen on the turnover rates. And if we see dramatically lower rates over the next couple years, you know, there's nothing saying we can't change the assumption off cycle. It doesn't have to be every 5 years. But
okay.
We need to set the rates based on what we've seen and what we're expecting.
How material is this, the changes you're proposing to the overall calculation of liabilities and costs?
I guess that's what I was trying to refer. Thanks, Bill.
So this, just on the overall, you know, liability side, the change to the new proposed rates was pretty small. It was like a 0.1% increase in the total actuarial accrued liability, and it actually decreased the normal costs a little bit as well, just because we're increasing those rates, so we're assuming more people, you know, are going to leave up front. So overall actuarial liability, very small impact, and actually a small decrease in the annual cost of the plan.
Yeah, Bill, out of $4.7 or so billion dollars in liability, the change in the turnover rates caused a liability increase of less than $6 million. So
okay.
It has a very small impact on the overall results.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions on turnover specifically, kind of before I move forward? Okay. The next assumption is disability. I think Jeff had kind of mentioned this, that so this is the likelihood an active participant will become disabled before leaving retirement or before leaving to retire. We currently have age-based rates with a higher rate of disablement among older members. In the middle of the page there, you'll see our findings. There was a small number of disabilities over the five-year period at only 7, but that was right in line with our assumption with 7 expected. Because of that, we see no reason to update the rates we currently have. A sampling of those is in the bottom right corner. And these rates are also in line with the disability rates for other Texas public safety plans, including San Antonio and Fort Worth. So although there wasn't a lot of experience to go off of here, we're confident that what we have currently in there is sufficient for projecting experience going forward. Go to the next page. It's kind of one of the bigger assumptions, retirement, and another one that the last 5 years were a particularly volatile time to be looking at retirement given the plan changes. We currently have 5 different sets of retirement rates with different rates for participants that have elected the drop and participants that are not in the drop. Currently, all the rates are age-based, meaning, you know, we have lower percentage of retirement assumed at younger ages and going up from there until an ultimate rate of 100% retirement is assumed. For drop participants, the rates are different for police and fire. And for all participants in the drop, they're assumed to retire after 8 years. For non-drop participants, we have the same rates for police and fire, but they're different tables based on date of hire and service. And the maximum rate is set to 100% once the 90% maximum benefit multiplier is reached. You go to the next slide. This is just a summary of the findings. Let's start with the drop participants. Once again, retirement patterns during experience were volatile. We saw very high retirement among drop participants during 2017, which is not surprising given the plan changes, and this was followed by much lower retirement during 2018 and 2019. Basically, everybody who, you know, was already planning on leaving kind of did in 2017, and then it really leveled off in 2018 and 2019. Actually, in total, if you looked at the five-year period, experience is actually lower than expected for fire, but a little greater than expected for police. For fire, we had 346 actual retirements compared to 392 expected. For police, it was 555 actual compared to 494 expected. Because of the volatility, when we set our new rates, we kind of placed a heavier emphasis on the 2018 and 2019 experience. We kind of figure, especially given the new rules for the drop and new provisions, that the experience after the plan changes was going to be much more in line with what we'll see going forward. For non-drop participants, there was similar volatility. The spike in retirement came a little earlier in 2016. And the exposure group for the non-drop participants grew each year, you know, whereas you used to have almost everybody elect to enter the drop when they could. Once the plan changes went in place in 2017, fewer people were electing drop, and so you saw that kind of non-drop group grow each year. Overall, for the non-drop group, we saw 228 actual retirements compared to 282 expected. Let's go to the next page, I'll run through what our recommendations are for drop participants. Once again, the rates, the current and proposed rates are at the bottom. Fire is in red, police is in blue. For both groups, we're recommending bringing up the ultimate 100% retirement age from 67 to 65. And we're going to increase the retirement ages for most ages. Another piece of this is, I said before that we're currently assuming that after a participant is in the drop for 8 years that they'll retire, we're going to move that back to the 10-year maximum. And then the next couple of slides are just graphically showing, you know, this is FIRE. So once again, the expected rate, that's our current assumption, is there in that kind of teal green. The actual experience is in red, and the proposed rate is in blue. You kind of always see towards the right half, rates don't always get up to that 100%. The actual rates never really get up to our 100%. But we always want our assumption to be up there. You have to have kind of a cutoff point where you assume everybody will retire at a certain point. You're always going to have one or two people or a small group of people who kind of hang on, and they're in the exposure group every year, which is kind of why you see those lower retirement at 67 plus, even though you'd assume most people do leave eventually. The next page is just the same thing, just graphic of the police, our current and proposed rates. Once again, just bringing the rates up at most ages, trying to get it more in line with that experience, although, you know, there was some volatility. Any questions on the drop retirement rates before I move on to the other group? All right, let me go to the next page. Oh, sorry, I'm jumping ahead. There's two other drop-related assumptions. One is the drop utilization. So this is the participant electing to enter the drop. As Jeff had mentioned, following the 2017 plan changes, we're not assuming anybody enters the drop. We did see a small group of participants in 2018 and 2019 enter the drop, and these were mainly all participants who had reached their maximum years of pensionable service. We still think the assumption that no members will enter the drop is one we'd like to maintain, but we will definitely be tracking this, particularly going forward, to see if there is still, you know, to see who is entering the drop. Are they mainly people with, you know, the maximum years of service, and tracking that to see if we should tweak this in the future. But for now, we would recommend maintaining the assumption that no members enter the drop. The other piece of the drop retirement assumption is the annuitization rate, and this is the interest rate. So currently, we are assuming 3% is applied to account balances as of September 1, 2017, payable at retirement. Our recommendation is to lower this to 2.75, and this is an assumption we actually look at annually and change as necessary based on feedback from the fund office.
Okay. Is that based on what we're actually paying at now, where the rates are, the blended rates?
Yes, I had talked to Jeff about this, and when we did the plan changes originally, we put it at 2.75, and then when rates of treasuries kind of increased there for a little while, for one valuation, I think we increased it to 3, but where we are now and with our inflation assumptions, the 2.75 seems like a good number for now.
Okay, and now I'll move to the non-drop group on the next page. So these are our recommended rates for the non-drop group. We're recommending decreases for most ages. The tables below show our current and proposed rates. This one's a little different. So we had, as I mentioned, we had different rates based on data prior, kind of broken it into two groups, whereas before we had three groups. On the left, these are members that were hired prior to March 2011, and they had 20 years of service as of the plan changes. This entitled them to slightly different benefit provisions because they were already eligible for the 20 and out as of the plan change date. The other group would be people who were still hired prior to March 2011, but they didn't have the 20 years of service as of the plan changes, or participants hired after March 2011. We'd originally had different rates for the group that was hired after March 2011, but given that the the plan provisions for this group are not going to be very different now for the pre-2011 less than 20 years of service group. We're proposing rates for that group in combination. We also, no one has retired if they were hired on or after March 1, 2011. So during this experience study, there wasn't actually an experience to study for that group. So we don't really see any reason not to combine them with the other group. We would anticipate retirement patterns to be similar for the two. Then so the next page is just once again a graph of the proposed rates compared to the actual experience and the expected rate. Just kind of bringing it down, the blue rate is our proposed. We're kind of overall kind of keeping that same pattern, but bringing it down at certain ages and then bringing it up at the higher ages. And then the next page is the other group. And same thing here. And actually, the actual rate for this group is very low, which makes sense. I mean, if you had, these are mainly younger people or people with less service than the other group. So we haven't seen a whole lot of experience for this group to start, which is why that actual rate is pretty low here. And we have brought down our proposed assumption, but we'd expect that this is kind of going to be the main group going forward. So in the next experience study, 5 years from now, you should have a lot more experience to look at for this group. Any questions on active retirement rates before I move on to inactive vested? Okay, let's go to the next page. So as mentioned before, we have a separate assumption. So these are people who are vested in the plan, are entitled to a deferred annuity once they reach retirement age, but haven't retired yet or aren't old enough to retire yet. We currently have two separate assumptions. We have for persons who terminated before September 2017, we're going to assume they retire at age 50, which is the normal retirement age that they would be entitled to. For persons who terminated after that point, we're assuming the new normal retirement age, 58. We're also currently, I had mentioned this earlier, we're assuming that people we're valuing the greater actuarial value of the cash out and the deferred annuity. We look to see how many people are actually taking the cash out and how many people are waiting until normal retirement age to retire. And it did look like about a quarter were retiring and taking the deferred annuity, and the average age of that was 50. And then the other about 74% were taking a cash out at an average age of 38. So our recommendation is to keep the assumed retirement ages as is. And, you know, as people begin to terminate after September 1, 2017, we think they will retire later in accordance with the new normal retirement age. We're also going to add an assumption that 75% of persons who terminate with a vested benefit will take a lump sum cash out at age 40, consistent with the experience. And then the other 25% will be assumed to go on and retire at normal retirement age. Next page, just spousal assumptions. So this is, you know, how many participants we think will have a spouse upon retirement or death from active status, and then what age that spouse will be. The current assumption is that 75% of participants will be married with a spouse, and on average, males are assumed to be 3 years older than females at retirement. We looked at approximately 78% of participants in total were married at the time of retirement, so we're okay with maintaining that 75% assumption. We think experience, you know, was in line with that. We don't anticipate any changes to that going forward. On average, male participants had a female spouse that was 2.6 years younger, while female participants tended to have male spouses that were about half a year older. But this includes for females. One, the number of female participants is pretty small, so you can get a lot of fluctuations in experience when you have a smaller group. And that's kind of what we saw with the female participants. There was 1 year that was kind of skewing the overall results. If you remove that year, the average age for female participants was 2.3 years older. Once again, we're okay with maintaining the spousal age assumption of males being 3 years older than their spouses. That was a lot of information on demographic assumptions. Does anybody have any questions before we move on to the economic assumptions? Okay. You can hop forward a couple of slides, actually. I'll hand it back over to Jeff to cover economic stuff.
All right, thanks, Caitlin. So when we're looking at the economic assumptions, we're building up to the discount rate or the investment rate of return. We look at the inflation component and the real rate of return. You know, payroll growth and inflation are often the same assumption in evaluations. They don't have to be, but we think in this case it makes sense. If we want to move to the next page, please. Currently, your inflation assumption is 2 3/4, and really, inflation and payroll growth, we look at kind of similar because where this matters, payroll growth is used as part of the amortization of the unfunded liability, so that's why it matters as an assumption. Currently, your assumption for inflation is 2 3/4. It's kind of in the middle of the OASB trustees report for 2019. You know, we know inflation has been lower in recent years and in the past. We think lowering, and it is based on the OASB study and other public sector plans we work on, most of them have an assumption in the 2 2 3/4 range. We think lowering the 2.5% makes sense. And that'll be in conjunction with, on the next page, please, the investment return. Your current assumption is 7.25. And really, you're right in line currently with the public sector universe as a whole. NASRA, which is the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, they come out with a big public fund survey once or twice a year. The latest update was in February of this year. And you can see there the median return for the public sector universe, the return assumption, I should say, is 7.25. The average assumption was 7.22%. In the last 2 years, the assumption median has gone from 7.5 down to 7.25. Less than 35% now have an assumption at 7.5 or greater, which was just 50% 2 years ago. That's a pretty big drop in 2 years, the number of plans that have dropped their rates. And over the last 10 years, the median has dropped from 8% in 2010 to 7.5% 2 years ago to 7.25% now. And you can see in that graph on the right-hand side of the page, you can see 20 years ago or even, you know, 10 years ago, almost everybody was using 8%. That was just kind of standard. You know, you plug it in and go, okay, what's your return assumption? It's 8%. Great. Let's just keep moving on. That's changed over time. You hardly see any in the current year, which is the far right-hand column. There's hardly any at 8%. You get a few outliers who just will not change. You know, they want to maintain higher return assumption means a lower liability, which means a lower contribution rate. Yeah, that makes sense if it's reasonable with your portfolio, but there's not a whole lot of portfolios out there, I'm guessing, where 8% is reasonable anymore. Usually we would have a little bit of information on here about your real rate of return based on the capital market assumptions. We did not include that this year. I chose not to include that because with your portfolio, the changes that have occurred and are occurring, it's a little more difficult than just plopping in your asset allocations and determining a real rate of return. And Makita could speak more to that, obviously, about what they assume for a real rate of return. But you currently have a 4.5% spread between your inflation assumption and your return assumption. So that's essentially what you're saying your real rate of return is right now is 4.5%.
Can we let Leo comment on that now, what he's seeing on that real rate of return for us?
Bill and everybody else, good morning. This is Leo. I think so far everything I've heard is it's very reasonable. The 7.25, you know, I've seen essentially the majority of my clients and other peers at the minimum have discussions and must, you know, opt in to reduce some degree. I think when it comes to rate of returns, they're difficult to predict, especially in your case. You have about a quarter of your assets in illiquid, and those are driven by two main general partner relationships, as you know, with Lone Star and Half. When we plotted and modeled expected rate of returns for you using our latest projections, which were at the time the December 31, 2019 numbers, and we did this, I think, back in February or March, I think we came up with about a 7.2, but we noted in the appendix that there was a huge range of outcomes in your case according to just how you model just those legacy assets and according to what standard deviation you account for and what correlation. All that matters into coming up with your projection, and the range was somewhere from about 4.5% to about 8%. So ultimately, we concluded 7.25%, you know, was reasonable given our, you know, median range at the time using a variety of assumptions, but also noted that, you know, if you, I would note that if you were to lower it to 7, you know, it would also be reasonable, but also more conservative given the unknown as to how these legacy assets will perform. That's going to be a big driver, and that's what it makes modeling a bit harder in your case.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Leo. So we're going to let's skip past page 40. 41 is on there, just the average asset allocations. We're not, that's just informational. We're not going to go through that. On page 42, you can see the returns over the last 5 years. Obviously, you know, there was a big write-down of assets about 5 years ago that affected returns. And then just trying to, like Leo said, you've got a high percentage of the liquid assets currently, so that's obviously had a negative impact on returns. Once you kind of reallocate your portfolio where you want it to be, we expect the future this to be a little different, but it is what it is over the last 5 years. On page 43, so based on the inflation assumption range and the target asset allocation, you know, I think anywhere between 6.5% and 7.25% is probably reasonable. I know 6.5% is on the lower side for public sector plans, and we're not recommending. I mean, we provide a range when it comes to investment returns because we know it is volatile, and there are reasonable ranges. You know, it's hard for us to say this one exact rate is where you should be. We included 6.5% because I know there's been discussion in the past of what's appropriate, and I know Gilbert's, you know, asked before about lower rates. I think was based on some experience with Houston, and we just decided to show several rates here. So, you know, I think 7 makes sense, certainly, but we provide the range for you to decide on. On the next page, but one thing I wanted to point out, though, I'm sorry, on page 43 still, I apologize, John. You know, the 4.5% spread that I mentioned between your current inflation assumption and your return assumption, that does not have to be maintained. But just keep in mind that if you're lowering your inflation assumption but not your return assumption, you're implying that the real rate of return percentage is increased. So with your portfolio, that, you know, we provide, I think we'd look to Leo for whether that would make sense, but now the other way, I think, is perfectly reasonable. If you decided to lower your discount rate or your investment return more than your inflation assumption and saying you have a shorter spread, a smaller real rate return, I think that would probably make more sense than having it go the other way. But just wanted to point that out. I know there's a lot of investment professionals, and you guys obviously understand this, but just thought it's worth noting anyways.
Hey, Jeff, this is Nick. Just specifically on the inflation assumption, with 30-year treasuries at 1.3%, and I haven't looked at, like, TIPS yields and all that kind of stuff, but I know that any measure of go-forward inflation today on a broad basis is materially lower than 2 to 2.75. So how do we justify that given every market indicator tells us it's sub 2% right now?
Well, I guess, and honestly, I debated even including an inflation discussion in here, because really what you're focused on is the payroll growth assumption, and they don't have to be the same. Because inflation assumption is not what you're using for amortization purposes, it's the payroll growth. We could say your inflation assumption is 1.25 if we want, and it's not going to really impact anything unless we change the payroll growth assumption to 1.25 also. So there was, I was debating on this, but usually there is a discussion on inflation. And you're right, the current inflation assumptions are much lower. If we want to say the inflation is lower than 2.5, we're going to go down as low as you want. Frankly, I don't care. I mean, not that I don't care, but it's not material to the results because it's the payroll growth that really we're focused on. Does that make sense?
But it should, well, this is a long-term inflation assumption, not the next 5 years too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
This is Gilbert. Can I say something real quick, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Yeah. So, Nick, the TIPS break-evens are right around 1.5 plus or minus. So just whether I agree with that or not, I'm just saying that as a data point, number one. Number two, yeah, I mean, like anything else, and for the new trustees, you know, you either pay the piper, you know, now or you pay the piper later. But what is, you know, the discount rate is just sort of forcing you to realize things and pay more over time. When I was at Metro, I was chairman of Metro. I wasn't on the pension board, but I, you know, we appointed the trustees. And because, you know, I was trying to really – get things with what I thought was more reasonable. 7 years ago, we moved our return assumption to 6.75. So I just want to put that in context. So that has done a lot to get our fund healthy because it has forced us at Metro to put more money into the plan. Now, I know that would have been really dramatic for us 7 years ago, but I just want to give a data point. Because, you know, what is, and you're just paying the piper either sort of more now. The advantage to more now is then there's more money working for you, in theory. So, anyways, I just wanted to add that, Bill, for everyone to close the loop on data points.
Yeah, I mean, I think what makes this a little different or unique, and I think we're going to talk about lowering it in a little while, but the fact that we've got a, you know, mandate from the state as to how much the city will contribute, whether we change the state or not is not going to change the city's contribution, where in a normal environment that would be the impact. And we can discuss this, but it's unfortunately it's not going to bring more money into the system between now and 2024.
Right. That's it for me.
Correct.
Jeff, we're back to you, Jeff.
Okay, thanks. If we were to go to the payroll growth discussion on page 48, which is, and Nick, I agree with you as far as the inflation assumption. We can set it whatever the board's comfortable with, but really payroll growth is what we're looking at for amortization purposes. On the next page, please. So you're currently amortizing the unfunded liability on a 30-year loan percent of payroll basis. And this would, it's being done to determine an actuarially determined contribution, which is great, except as the chairman pointed out, the city's not paying the actuarially determined contribution. They're paying a mandated rate statute. So it's not as, obviously it's not important as it is, but the payroll growth assumption matters for the amortization But based on changes to the meat and fur and long-term assumptions, we think lowering from 2.75 to 2.5 makes sense. It doesn't have to be equivalent to inflation. It's usually such inflation or inflation plus a productivity component to the salary. So you can have a 2% inflation and a 2.75 payroll growth. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing unusual about that. On the next page, on page 45, we can see what's happened to the payroll over the last several years. Obviously, in January 1, 17 and 18 valuations, you know, reflect what happened in 16 and 17. So there were drops. There were 3 years in a row of pretty significant drops in payroll. And then it's come up the last couple years with the prior meet and confer agreement and the double step rate raises. So for the first time, the projected valuation payroll looks to be in line with the city's hiring plan payroll assumptions. Hopefully it'll maintain that going forward. That's really important to the long-term outlook for this system. But over the last few years, obviously, you know, the average, we're not going to set anything based on the average over the last 5 years because so much unusual has happened over the last few years. But this is what's happened over the interim short term. On the next page, you know, this is one where we know what happened over the last several years, and we had the NEAT-CONFER agreement, and there's a NEAT-CONFER agreement went into effect October 19 through September 2022. So really, this kind of set our assumption for us. It was much easier to say, okay, once we have this NEAT-CONFER, we know what to expect, and the bargaining occurs every 3 years. So we took into account, if you can go ahead and go to the next page, please. So the bottom is what we're proposing because we see, you know, we kind of simplified it to officers and then the three groups have these raises over the next 3 years, 3.25, 3, or 2.5. Whereas you can see we had six different sets of salary assumptions in the prior couple of years based on the prior meet and confer agreement. This has a higher long-term raise assumption. We set the payroll growth at 2.5. We know that for the bulk of the members, the increases will be greater than that over the next 3 years, but it's just for the next 3 years. We didn't want to set a long-term assumption based on a three-year increase. We think 2.5 is still reasonable for the payroll growth assumption long-term. And as meet confers change, as bargaining continues, we'll reset the salary assumptions with the new meet confer agreements when they're issued. On the next page, page 48, the admin expense assumption. This is an assumption really we're looking to the system for. For most plans, this is one where we just kind of set ourselves as needed. But your plan obviously is a little bit different. The current assumption is it'll be the greater of $8.5 million a year or 1% of compensation pay. But you know, there's been a lot of fluctuations the last few years, and a lot of that has to do with lawsuits and legal expenses and increased actuarial fees with the plan changes and increased investment fees and changing and all sorts of stuff. So there's been fluctuations, and we're going to look at the system on this. Tentatively, Kelly said, just stick with the current 8.5 for now. We'll decide if that needs to be updated. So that's where we are at the moment. This does impact, of course, the actual determined contribution, whatever the assumption is.
Kelly, quick question. Why do we even have 1% of comp pay? That's $4 million. I mean,
that's because if you go out 15, 20 years, that 1% becomes more than the 8.5. But right now, it's less.
Okay. That's logical. Thank you.
So that's where we are at the moment, and we'll update this based on feedback from Kelly and the fund staff. So on the next page, COLA. This one is a little tricky. We didn't change this for the purpose of the study. The current assumption is that it will be a 2% simple COLA issued once the system is projected to be 70% funded on a market value basis after the COLA is reflected. And that's based on the statute. Currently, which was in the 2019 valuation, that was projected to occur October of 2050. What, October? I think it's just said January, actually, but in 2050. So that's a ways out, obviously. And we've been updating this annually. But until we have final assets and we have final assumptions, final assumptions, we're maintaining this. So we'll update it with evaluation as needed. But at this point, the projections haven't been run until we get the final set of assumptions. So if anything, that date probably would be in the future. So if that date gets pushed out further, that's less of a liability increase than anticipated. There's not a ton of cost right now associated with this assumption because it's not projected to occur for another 30 years. So ideally we'll get to the point where it's projected sooner, meaning you're better funded, but it is what it is right now. So right now it's projected 30 years out, and we'll update that annually with evaluation. So really that's the next few pages are actuarial cost methods and asset smoothing and amortization. We're not recommending any changes to the methods. Like I mentioned earlier, your cost method, the traditional entry age, is working well. It's the most common method for public sector funds. That's on page 51, just in case you want to go through. It's the most common method. The next page, 52, is the asset smoothing method. Again, the most common method, 5-year straight line amortization, gain loss. No need to update that. And on page 53 is the amortization method. Currently, we're using just the 30-year level percent of pay. I guess I do want to talk about this for a second, because we are required to show an actuarially determined contribution. So we have to have a amortization method to determine that. Right now, it's a 30-year level percent of pay. We're using 30 years each year. Normally, we would not recommend a rolling 30-year amortization method because that doesn't really amortize anything. However, in this case, with the city paying statutory contribution rates, the amortization method's not driving anything. It's driving projections when you're projected to be funded, but the amortization method's different for the projections than for this purpose. So if you get to the point where the city ever chooses to fund based on the actual determined contribution or is allowed to do that, I guess they could if they wanted to, but if they choose to fund based on the actuarial contribution, or if the effective amortization period becomes less than 30 years, that is, the system is predicted to be fully funded in 30 years, then we would definitely recommend changing that amortization method, have a step rate down or have a layered amortization approach. But as it is now, it's fine the way it is because it's statutory contribution rates. So with
I'd like to add just a bit on this amortization piece. You know, everything that Jeff is talking about here really applies to the regular plan and not the supplemental plan in particular. So the way that that currently is being amortized is a 10-year rolling basis, which now, based on the legislation that was passed in the last legislative session, a 10-year rolling period will never achieve 100% funding. So that means our funding policy for the supplemental plan doesn't meet the requirements of Senate Bill 2224. So I have been working with the city on changing the way the supplemental plan is funded, and I'm having good luck, and they are looking at the numbers. And I believe between myself and their city actuary, we've come up with a plan that seems to work. Jeff has not seen that yet.
So I need Siegel to take a look at that. I do have a meeting with the city on Tuesday to talk more about it, but I will be, I anticipate bringing back a change to the way that the supplemental plan is funded at the next board meeting based on that, so we can be in compliance with the current law.
And Kelly, that's a good point. I apologize. We should have mentioned in here that this amortization method was for the main plan and not the supplemental, but you're absolutely correct. So with that, I know we went a little bit longer than we had allotted, and I apologize. We've concluded our presentation. Are there any questions at this point?
Yeah, Jeff, Joe Schutz.
Yes.
I have a question on page 13, kind of going over the recommendations. What on the different recommendations there, did you calculate out what the total normal cost as the percentage of comp pay would be as the discount rate changes?
Yes. One second here. It is actually, it's not too, let me see one second here. So prior to any assumption changes, in line with the $160.7 million, total normal cost was 14.56% of pay, but before it's projected. So
including admin expenses or excluding?
No, I'm sorry. That's just the normal cost. Okay. The normal cost plus admin 16.64.
Okay.
And then the employees are expected to contribute 13.5. So the city's normal cost is, before any assumption changes, is 3.14%, including the assumption changes. But prior to the discount rate changes, the city's normal cost is 3.6%.
And then, as the discount rate changes going down, does the normal cost increase or decrease?
Yes, it does. Let me see if I can get that for you real quick.
So with the change to 7%, it looks like it goes up to 4.6%. That's the total with the admin piece and the employee share offset.
Yeah. So really the normal cost is, in my opinion, based on experience with other plans, other police and fire plans, your normal cost is not, in my opinion, bad. Bad is not a – I guess that's not an actuarial term, but your normal cost is not overly out of line at all. It's not out of line. I mean, it's – especially the city's portion, because the employees are paying a pretty good chunk of the cost of the benefits. It's obviously the unfunded liability that's driving the cost. I mean, you can see on page 13 there that Joe was looking at, you know, you've got a recommended contribution just last year was $152 million. Well, $135 million was unfunded liability. You know, only $11.6 million before interest was the employer normal cost. So, you know, it's obviously not the cost of the benefits as they are today, the way it's set up, is driving the cost. It's paying down the unfunded liability. And I'm not, you know, going into what caused the unfunded liability. There's been various reasons unfunded liability has increased over the years. But I'm just saying, you know, if the unfunded liability magically disappeared, the city would love what they were paying. But obviously, you've got to take that into account where we are today.
Okay. Kelly, let me ask you a quick question here, just procedural. I know we're not going to approve till we get into the regular meeting the report and or any direction to Siegel, but should we discuss where people are now, or should we wait till we get to the regular meeting for that?
I think we should discuss it now. I think that's a good idea to find out where we are, and then when we get in the regular meeting, we can make whatever motions the board thinks is appropriate.
Okay, so I would suggest if we separate the inflation investment discussion for 1 minute, does anybody have problems with the rest of the report? Anything that they have any difficulty approving?
Do we need to, like, accept the report, and do you need a motion for that, Bill?
We will when we get to the regular meeting. We're in the public meeting now. So when we get, after we recess this meeting, we'll go into the public meeting and do those motions to accept the report at that point in time.
Thank you. Okay.
So really,
Bill, are you going to suggest a specific reduction in the discount rate to a specific number instead of the range of 6.5 to 7.25?
Yes, I think we are. I was trying to take the rest of the report, which I think may be less controversial, and then we'll discuss exactly that. Kelly has a recommendation on that as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Hi, this is Susan. Are we going to look at the thing the actuary was talking about, the spread between the assumed rate and the discount rate? I thought that was an interesting spread, and I just wanted to know whether that would be part of the discussion, or
yeah,
would
I'm
that
kind of-
be...
Yes, that will be part of the second discussion. I'm trying to break it into two pieces. One is the rest of the report, the actuarial recommendations, mortality, demographics, et cetera, and then we're going to specifically talk about the inflation and the investment rate.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So I'm gathering this, other than that issue, there is no problems with the rest of the report that anybody may have?
I'm okay. Correct.
Okay. That's good. Then let's, Kelly, do you want to tell them what you're thinking or recommending on the discount rate and the inflation rate?
I have, this is obviously a really difficult number to pinpoint because there's so much unknown in it in any environment, but especially in our environment with our challenging portfolio. It's really difficult to say what the number should be. But looking at our portfolio and combining that with, you know, this inflation environment, that whether we lower that number to 2.7 or 2.5 from 2.75, you know, inflation is low. I mean, we know that. So the real rate of return on the investments is just going to have to be much higher. So when I look at that, when I look at the time that it's taking to liquidate our challenging legacy portfolio, that's taken longer than we expected. When I look at the new Makita assumptions of the 6.46 to the 7.2, I really have a hard time keeping the total number at 7.25. So I would feel more comfortable with a 7% or a 6.75. I think 6.5 is too low at this point. But I do feel like a reduction is appropriate. And, yes, I know that will make our funding level go down, and nobody will want to see that. But I think it's a more accurate view of actually where the pension plan is. As far as putting the inflation assumption and the payroll growth assumption at two different numbers, I guess I agree with Jeff that I've really never – well, he didn't say this, but I typically see those two numbers to be the same. So I don't know what it really means to have them to be different. But in reality, you know, the inflation assumption is going to be lower than 2.5 for an extended period of time. So it doesn't make sense to me to keep that at 2.75.
So if I'm reading you, you're suggesting we go to 2.5 and then take the investment rate down to 7 or even discuss going to 6.75?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get everybody else's thoughts, but let's just point out we don't need to make that decision. We want to have to give direction to Siegel on completing it, but we're not going to make the final decision because if we're going to do something like this, we do feel we have an obligation to both the city and to the people who passed the bill to at least give them a heads up before we would actually formally approve something like that. But is anybody, let's just, you know, any other comments on Kelly's suggestion on lowering inflation by
I'm happy to chime in, Bill. It's Gilbert.
Gilbert.
Yeah, I'd like to go. I mean, I know it's going to look bad and all those things, but, you know, what is. And I think, you know, we have a short window to be bold and do things, you know, sort of post the law, et cetera. And I'd want to go as low as possible. So to the extent Kelly, and we got to let her sort of drive some of that. If she's comfortable with 6.75, that would be my recommendation.
Hey, this is Rob French. I second that.
Okay.
This is Steve Ido. I agree with that, too.
This is Susan. And it's Susan. I would go along.
Yeah, same.
Anybody opposed to that?
Well, I would consider maybe targeting 25 basis points this year and then 25 next year. I would do it maybe over 2 years. That we have to think about just the headline numbers of what that does to the funded ratio, coupled with the likely investment loss that we're going to have, you know, this year, assuming markets, you know, don't go up. So I think at a minimum, we should look at that sensitivity, what it does to those ratios before we sign off on a number.
And can we, I'd like to hear Kent and Leo kind of respond to what I've said in the 6.75 and 7, if that's okay.
This is Kent, and I heard what you said, and I agree with it completely. And just to reiterate a couple of things that, you know, we talked about is that the current the long-term asset allocation, and, you know, combined with Makita's assumptions, you know, does you know, calculate to a 7.2% return. And so, you know, that's one data point. But then the other thing that Leo brought forth, and we live with every day is, you know, what are our current assets? Where are they going to end up? As Kelly, you mentioned, it's taking, you know, longer than we expected to liquidate those legacy assets. And there's, you know, Leo talked about kind of the standard deviation that's built into those, which is, you know, kind of higher, like venture capital type of standard deviation. So there's, you know, there's downside risk there. So I would be, you know, kind of, you talked about 6.75 to 7, and I understand what Nick said, but I would also kind of gravitate somewhat lower there, more towards 6.75. And I'll pass it on to Leo if he's still on to provide additional comment.
Yes, Kent, I'm still on, and I generally agree. I think going down is in order. Going to 6.75 is reasonable as well. One thing that across all clients that I've seen is that, again, maintaining that consistency in, for example, in inflation, in payroll growth, et cetera, I think, generally speaking, that's something I don't recall the last time I've seen an inconsistency there in terms of using different numbers. I think the other question is, you know, what is the real rate of return going forward? And if you reduce the inflation rate to 2.5, but cut the rate to 6.75, then you're reducing that real return assumption by 25 basis points, which I think is reasonable as well. So so to me, that's fine. The last thing I would caution is when you look at, for example, the inflation expectation over 30 years and you look at break-even rates from TIPS versus Treasury, that's quite volatile, and here we're looking at long-term. So I would caution with making drastic changes to the inflation assumption. I think reducing by 25 or 50 basis points is quite reasonable, and if there is support to go down to 50 basis points to 6.75, that's very reasonable. And I've seen also most clients do it gradually as opposed to one huge change upfront.
Let me ask Jeff, how much extra work is it if we have you guys look at it at both rates and bring it, and next month we make a final decision? Is that a lot more work or just a very small incremental amount?
Well, I mean, what rates are you talking
about? We're talking about either a 7 with a 2.5% inflation rate,
sure,
or a 2.5% 6.5% inflation rate and 6.75%.
Well, for purposes of the cost, ignore the inflation rate. Just, page 13 of the presentation, it has results at 7.75% and
I was referring to how much work it'll be for you to look at both of those scenarios.
Well, they're there. I mean, the inflation rate, it's the payroll growth is what we're concerned about really for amortization purposes. Now, if we're saying we need to change the payroll growth rate, that's a different discussion. There's a little bit of work involved there, but based on the meet and confer agreement, I think currently a 2.5% payroll growth assumption sounds reasonable to me. The inflation is, you know, this goes back to what I said. I almost didn't even include an inflation discussion. I mean, you kind of need to when you're building up to a discount rate, include inflation. But
yeah,
inflation is not a direct impact on the results because you don't have to have your inflation and your payroll growth set the same. It's not unreasonable at all to have a lower inflation assumption knowing that there's going to be raises to the members that are above inflation. So having the payroll growth at 2.5, I think is fine. We can say the inflation's 2 or 2.25 or whatever you want, and that's really not going to impact what we're doing here.
So Jeff, the blue column and the red column there on page 13, those have been calculated assuming a 2.5% payroll growth, right?
Correct. Because that,
yeah. It's already built in here.
I'm sorry. I guess I wasn't clear about that. Maybe I wasn't. These columns build going across. So you've got the 2020 preliminary results, and then the column to the right of that has the demographic and salary scale changes, and then the right of that includes the payroll growth change for amortization purposes, and then everything going to the right includes everything previous. So the 7% column includes all of the demographic salary scale and the 2.5% payroll growth change. Same with the 6.75 and 6.5. So regardless of inflation, if the payroll growth assumption stays at 2.5, then you have the results there at 7% and 6.75 and 6.5 also.
Yeah,
okay,
right. Yeah.
No extra work.
I see it now.
Yeah, there's no extra work. So, okay, why don't we do that then? Why don't we look at these numbers, make that final decision next month? There's not a rush because our audit is probably going to be delayed because of getting information late from some of our private equities. And next month, we'll make a decision on 7 or 6.75.
Okay.
But
I mean,
when we go back to the regular meeting, you'll adopt the other assumptions that you agree with, correct?
Pardon me?
But the idea is all of the other assumptions, when we go back to the regular meeting, is the board going to consider those?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, great.
This is Leo. Just one question. So just to make sure I understand this. So assuming that the only difference is the 6.75 and the 7%, the funded status only goes down 1%, right, on that 25 basis points?
Correct.
That is quite low, right, compared to others that you've seen for 1%, for a 25 bps decline in the assumed rate of return to only lose 1% funded status. That seems pretty good trade-off, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's about, 1.25, 1.2% on the actuarial side. It can be greater. It just depends on the makeup of the fund and the liabilities versus the assets. But you're right. I mean, it's not a bad – I mean, the fund percentage isn't good, but it's not a bad drop considering you're dropping a quarter point. I agree with that.
Right.
And to that point, that's why I think 7 is a little bit better than going to 6.75. I don't think that would be very bold, and I don't know if I'm willing to be that bold right now.
Don't we have projected investment returns lower than 7.25 for the next couple years, then it grinds back up to 7.25? So if that's true, then lowering the 6.75 or 6.75 isn't a change right away because we have those lower numbers already baked in, And then the only other point I'd make is that if the markets don't move at all between now and the end of the year, we'll have, I would think, an investment loss, and our funded ratio could slip into the high 30s.
Right. And that was Nick, correct, Nick?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry. I worded that poorly. These results here do not have these are not projections as far as they don't include the projected lower asset returns. When we do the projections with the valuation, we'll use the interim assumptions that the system provides. This is just a snapshot as of one day, everything with a discount rate, a single discount rate. So those interim return assumptions we use in the projections are not included here.
Okay.
So just a question.
Go ahead, Susan.
I just was wondering that even if we assume a negative return for this year, isn't it smoothed over 5 years, and it wouldn't necessarily take us into the 30s?
Yes, asset gains and losses are smoothed over a five-year period. It's going to depend on the size of the loss, whether you get in the 30s.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, I think that's helpful. When we go to the regular meeting, we'll finalize whatever else we need to on this. I think we should get to the last two items on our public meeting agenda. Brenda is going to give us the quarterly financial report, which I think is on page 60 of Diligent, the way I see it.
It's on which page?
I think 60? It's page 60, yes.
Okay.
Okay, Brenda, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. This morning I'm going to be reviewing our first quarter financials. I want to start with the bridge chart. We began the year with a net position of $2.093 billion. We had investment-related transactions over the quarter that decreased the net position by $153 million. We had benefit and operations-related transactions that decreased our net position by $27.6 million. And the March 31st net position is $1.9 billion, down $181 million since 12/31, the first quarter. Obviously, the largest driver here is the investment-related transactions that have been occurring in the market.
Where would we go if we sell assets? Does that show anywhere, or is it just the wash at where we reinvested?
So if we're selling assets, yes, it'll show here as well.
Okay.
John, if you'll go to the next slide, please. I'm going to just briefly discuss some of the highlights from the financials. As we look at the investments as a whole, we ended the quarter at $1.852 billion compared to $1.989 billion for 2019, or a decrease of $137 million. Again, this decrease was driven by the performance of the equity and fixed income markets during the quarter. We move down to city and member receivables. Both of those were up over the quarter. That is related to the increase in the number of days that needed to be accrued at the end of the period. At the end of March, we accrued 14 days, and at the end of December, we accrued 7. Also, there's a small component of that increase that's related to the increase in the average day payroll over the period. If we move down to cash and cash equivalents, they decreased $45 million from 12/31. There were two portfolio rebalancings during the first quarter that used $17 million in cash. And additionally, the pension shortfall during the quarter was $26 million. As we continue to move down, we look at accounts payable and other accrued liabilities. Fund management fees are down about $1 million from the end of the year, just paying those year-end fees. Next, I want to move on, John, if you'll go to the next page and look at the changes in fiduciary position. Citi contributions increased $2 million as compared to last year. That is primarily related to the increase in the floor that went into effect at the beginning of 2020. The floor increased from $5.571 million to $5.724 million per pay period. Member net contributions increased $1.2 million year over year. And when we compared, we had an increase in the number of employees. We're up about 131 employees over 3/31/2019. When we move down and we look at net appreciation, depreciation of investments, obviously a significant change there, and again, primarily driven by the changes in the public and fixed income markets during the if we go down, we look at benefits paid to members. Net benefits paid to members increased $2.9 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $2.3 million. Survivor benefits increased by $721,000. There was a small decline in disability payments of $60,000. Again, this increase driven by new service retirement at higher monthly benefits. That's the primary driver here. And finally, if we look at staff salaries and benefits, they've increased year over year slightly, and that's primarily to the filling of some open positions and the timing of some payout of HSA. John, if you'll go to the next slide. This is the net benefit shortfall slide that we've been looking at in tracking. It just shows the change. The blue bar I've been tracking January 2017. The blue bar, total benefit contributions. The orange, total benefit payment. The gray is the shortfall. Then kind of the average month shortfall. Really, we're just tracking to see, you know, if the shortfall, which was $14 million in January of 2017, or the average shortfall, is now at the last quarter about $8.6 million. So we're continuing to make some progress. We see that the total benefit payment have inched up a little bit, but they have stabilized well. All that's very brief, but does anyone have any questions?
Okay, hearing none, we'll go on to the last item. Kelly, your contribution report.
Right. Okay, thank you. This is the normal report that you see every month. On page 65 of the diligent materials is the summary table that you're used to seeing. So the data in this table reflects the contributions received for the pay periods that began in March. There were two pay periods. For the month of March, we received $10.8 million worth of city contributions, which was 95% of the floor and 103% of the hiring plan. Since the bill has been in effect, we have received 90% of the floor amount in
The actual comp pay has been 90% of the floor amount and 98% of the hiring plan estimates. Since the bill was adopted, the floor has contributed $37.1 million to the plan. The employee contributions for the month are above both the hiring plan estimates for the month and the year to date, and 98% since inception. So as Jeff showed in his presentation, the city has done a good job of adding employees and adding pay to those employees. So those numbers are coming much closer to the hiring plan estimates that they had in 2017. The number of employees actually exceeds the hiring plan estimate by 30. The fire is over, as it has been, and police is short. I can tell you the number of fire employees that are over is less than it has been. So what we're seeing there is a little bit of attrition in fire, and I'm not sure if those positions will be replaced or not at this time with everything going on with the city. I have read that the city does plan on having 4 police recruit classes this year. That was something that I read in a financial report from the city. So it looks like things are on track, as you've seen for the last few months, related to contributions. That's all I have, unless there's questions.
Hearing none, can I get a motion to adjourn the public meeting?
So moved, Bill.
Thank you. Second?
Second from Armando.
Okay, Armando, thank you. All in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, thank you. We are adjourning the public meeting and go to the regular meeting at this point in time. And let me just skip forward here on the system. What page? Okay, the first thing is let's take a moment of silence for those retired police and fire officers who passed away in the last month or so. So let's just have a moment of silence. Okay, thank you. Next is approval of our minutes that you've all have seen. Any comments or changes to the minutes? Hearing none, can we get a motion to approve?
So moved.
Okay, approval. Second?
Second, Alan.
Second.
Alan, thank you. All in favor? Aye.
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 It may be in a virtual meeting easy to say. Anybody oppose?
No?
Okay. It's unanimously approved then. And also,
Bill, this is Kent Custer. I just wanted to ask if people, when they're making their motions, some of you have been adding names and some haven't, but we staff tries to keep track of that for the minutes and everything. So just if you could do that, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Do you have any that you need that for now going back?
Just on this last one, I think it was Gilbert and Armando, but if we could review that, that'd be helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, it was Gilbert as the motion.
Okay.
Was it Alan or Armando the second on the last one, the minutes?
Alan.
That's what I thought it was.
Correct.
Alan.
All right, thanks.
Okay,
yep.
Now anything unusual in the consent agenda, or is it just normal, Kelly?
Just normal business.
Normal business. Okay, so we need a motion to approve.
So moved. Gilbert.
Gilbert, okay.
Yes.
Second. Susan.
Susan, okay. Anybody opposed? No. So we carry that unanimously. Okay, then we go on here next to public comment. John, do you want to announce how people can comment if they want to?
If you'll press 5 and then star, that'll give me that you want to make a comment. I can unmute you.
Do we have anything?
I am not seeing any. No.
Give it another 30 seconds, and then we'll move on.
Still none.
Pardon me?
There are still none.
Okay. We've opened it up, and we'll close that now. Next item on our agenda is just the acceptance of the actuarial document that was presented by Jeff to be submitted to the Pension Review Board. So we're just taking that whole presentation where he gave us a lot of data, information, recommendations with some wide ranges. So even with the investment thing, he gave us that range there. So all we're approving now is submitting the report to the Pension Review Board. Anybody want to move that forward?
I'll make that motion to submit it. It's Gilbert.
Okay, I think Susan beat you to it, but was that you, Susan? You made that motion, and
yes.
Then Gilbert,
yes.
Second. We'll have,
yes,
you as a...
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any opposed? No? Okay, that's unanimously approved. Now, the next item is providing direction to Siegel on assumptions. I think as we discussed, we're all comfortable with everything that was recommended, with the exception of making a final determination on the investment rate next month at our meeting at that time. In the meantime, I think, you know, Kelly and I should give a heads up to the people that need to know, either at the city or at the state level, just that's what we're leaning towards lowering it. It's just a question of how much, so there's no surprises when they see the liability increase. I don't think, is there anything further we need to do there, Kelly?
No, and I have been in communications with the CFO and a couple of people in her office, as well as I sent the mayor's office an email about this conversation today and the potential of lowering it. So we'll continue to follow up with that and have some more conversations with everybody.
Okay, good.
Hey, Kelly, was there any reaction either way?
No, I haven't heard anything yet from anybody, but I have had good conversations with the city actuary about the issue.
Thank you.
Okay, the next two items, which were covered in the public meeting, don't need to be repeated, is the quarterly financial reports and the monthly contribution report.
Hey, Bill, I'm sorry if I missed it. Did we have a vote to have the board adopt the actuarial assumptions other than the discount rate? Did I miss that?
Well, I thought we were only providing direction. We provided direction to Siegel that to go forward with everything based on what they recommended, with the exception of the investment rate, which we'll finalize next month. But yes, we did.
Oh, okay. But was there actually
we're only providing direction. I thought we were going to make the final approval of everything at one time. I thought that's how you wanted to handle it.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. Next is a media report, and I'm going to ask Leo to help a little bit on this, but just wanted to make people aware. Gilbert provided us some data that the California Music Association had an ERISA lawsuit against their trustees and their consultant. And part of the settlement of that lawsuit was that Makita would be removed as an overseer of the consultant. Now, it was important to note that, one, they were not the current consultant. They were a prior consultant, as I understand it. They were not part of the lawsuit. They were not part of the settlement. It's a very strange result that they would be settled out and not be involved in it. But I just wanted people to be aware of it. It seemed to be sort of an oddball lawsuit. But, Leo, do you want to add anything?
Sorry, I was muted. I would summarize it as you know, Makita was not part of these settlement or lawsuit, was not an involved party. you know, some information gets picked up and the story is written as is. It's words just simply the overseer to an OCIO. And as part of the settlement, they're going to be changing providers, as I know. And the first one, the first change they made was to remove us as part of the settlement from being the overseer of the OCIO. And, you know, what changes will come next, I don't know. My expectation is they're going to conduct a full search for a new overseer and then a full search for an OCIO. That's what I would expect. But that's the extent of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and for the record, and Bill, for the record, this is Gilbert. I just want the record to reflect that, you know, I have no axe to grind. I just, given the amount of media attention that our board has had and the amount of sort of negative publicity, I just wanted to make sure, you know, we were prepared if asked any questions. So there was no motive one way or the other.
You know, I would thank Gilbert for bringing it to our attention. I mean, Gilbert's, you know, on a day-to-day basis, much more plugged into the investment industry and the publications and the rumor mill reports that are out there, and bringing them to our attention is very helpful so that we can be on top of that. So thanks, Gilbert, for that. I fully understand that and appreciate, and would like you to continue doing that.
My pleasure. Yeah, and my pleasure. To new board members, I do that on a regular basis, whether it's to Ken or to Kelly or to Bill, you know, because there's always something about something. And the media, you know, is listening more and more because of the way things are virtual to board meetings of all pension funds. So I assure you they'll write something about today, you know, in short order.
That's today's world.
Is there anything else or that I should add, or
I think that covers it. I mean, the bottom line, Leo, is it's a non-event, and I think that's what everyone needs to know. And hopefully that, you know, that'll put any media to rest.
Yeah, that is correct. You know, interestingly or not, I mean, this is the only client that I think you have asked any questions about it. But you know, we're fine. We're transparent and. You know, happy to address it, but yeah, it's a non-event, and we were not part of any lawsuit. But as a regular part of our business, we get, you know, asked on losses from clients and asset managers and other parties involved to, you know, set the information, and that's what we do. But we're not a party to any of that. So.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Our next item is a report on the audit committee. Briefly, after the last board meeting, the audit committee. Tina, Armando, Nick, I think it was Nick was there as myself, met with the partner of the auditors. Things are, you know, pretty stable there. Their whole team is back, so we have a stable team. We had a good result last year. They're very comfortable with staff being able to do things. They thought, you know, we were discussing virtual audits. I've seen them in some other cases, but they say they're prepared to do that. They talked a little bit about the bigger issues are the ones you would expect, valuations are, and on Huff, that likely those will come in later than normal or what's required, so there could be a delay in getting the final audit report. They also, you know, inquire about whether anybody knows of any fraud. I'll ask that question. So I've got a call with them later. I think next week, a fraud interview, but does any trustees know of any fraud with the system that I should report to them? Hearing nothing, I'll assume nobody has anything, but I'll give you a second to let me know.
Or you can call Bill directly.
Yeah. If you're aware of something, you want to let me know. I'm trying to think. I'm meeting with them early next week, so... tomorrow, you could let me know if you know of anything. I'm not aware of anything. So that was pretty much the meeting. Anybody else on the audit committee want to add anything?
Well,
no, sir. I think you pretty much covered it. Thank you, sir.
The only thing I'll add is that while it seems like this audit, a year ago, after all the low start steering committee meetings, but From what I recall, I did bring up the fact that on COVID disclosures, it seems to be like a requirement now for audit, and they seem to acknowledge it, but like, you know, that it won't have a material impact on this, on 2019. They seem to acknowledge it. I mean, Bill, what was their response? I forget what their response was, but they because I said that we were held up, even though we were almost done, but they said yes, but it's going to be a hold up.
In terms of the COVID disclosure, they did say that there are some disclosures that will be made in the financial statements, but
yeah.
I don't think there was anything specific at that stage of the game. They were still developing a lot of that.
Yeah. But they acknowledged it, and that's going to be part of the process as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's obvious, the control features, looking at how it works in a virtual world, they'll take a look at that as part of their work. And they'll be doing it probably virtually. I don't think any – are they in the office at all, Brenda?
Actually, the audit did start on May the 4th, and we are doing it virtually. We had for some years been using a portal to upload documents to eliminate sending them through email. So far it has been a very easy transition. We have biweekly status meetings to make sure we're staying on track. So we are moving along well so far.
Good. Okay, very good. Any questions on that? If not, Kelly, do you want to cover the CARES Act provisions?
Yes, thank you. At the last board meeting, I mentioned the CARES Act provision and the fact that some members had called to talk about hardships of whether they could get a hardship now that the CARES Act passed. And I mentioned that the CARES Act really doesn't apply to DPFP, and that is because the state statute really sets out the provisions of our plan, and the CARES Act doesn't override that. It primarily relates to 401A, 457, those types of 401K plans, IRAs. But there was certain members of the board that asked that I bring this back. So what I've included in your agenda materials is a summary of retirement plan provisions that Ice Miller actually put out earlier this week or Friday. I can't remember if I got it in time when the original posting or it came right after that. But basically the provisions that relate to other plans are an increase for in-service distributions of up to $100,000 with modifications of the tax treatments of those, increased limits on loans to $100,000, delay of loan repayments, and suspension of required minimum distributions. So as you all know, we don't have loans. We're not subject to RMDs anymore. We don't have in-service distribution, so really, you know, none of the provisions in here apply to DPFP. Are there any questions I can answer for you on this?
Okay. And now your travel discussion.
Travel or lack
thereof. Sure.
Right, kind of travel in your mind. So a lot of organizations, of course, are offering virtual travel, and the board still does have their requirements to meet the PRB guidelines. And CPRS is putting out a travel or a virtual class for their accredited fiduciary program. It's actually a four-module training class that's offered in two sections, module one and two, and then three and four. And Gilbert has asked to sign up for the first module. So we actually do have a request for training on this month's agenda if you'd like to approve that. The other thing I would also like to say is we have reached out to the PRB and asked about what training continuing ed applies. They did indicate that if trustees wanted, you could retake your initial PRB training classes, the ones you did through their website, even though you've done those before, those would count again for your continuing ed if you want to do those. Those are free and don't need to be on the agenda. There's also the GFOA, Government Finance Officers Association, is doing their conference this year online. It's, I think, a $400 registration fee. It might be a little more now. I think it's actually $400. They do have a pension track, and they have
certain, you know, you could take some of those classes to get your CE as well.
Could you send that out to everybody, just when they are or where they are, how we would go about that? Because I think anybody who's completing the third year of their term has to do another 4 hours, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. I have the list here, but basically it's Susan, Nick, Bill, and Gil, no, that's not right.
And me.
Well, I think Carol sent the list out. I had it here somewhere, but for some reason I can't seem to open it.
I think me, Kelly.
Right, right. Okay, Gilbert, Tina, Nick, and Bill need to do theirs by August 31st. Everybody else has more time.
Great. Okay,
so can I get a motion to approve Gilbert's request?
Sure. I'll move it. Does anybody want to second it?
Armando with the second.
Okay. Anybody opposed? Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Very good. You'll have to update us on what you learn.
I will.
Okay. You have something here, future investment-related travel. I assume is there something there?
No, that's all part of that item number 7. That's the typical A and B. There's no future investment related travel.
Okay, good. So we can move on to Kent.
Okay, John, if you can move on to the next slide and the next slide after that. Okay, so this is our asset allocation, and just a couple things to point up here. So this is as of April 30th. If you look kind of down and towards the bottom on the left side, you'll see the safety reserve. So there's 200, as of April 30th, there was $266 million in the safety reserve. And, you know, we roughly kind of think about $10 million a month of negative cash flow, even though kind of what Brenda showed from a benefits point of view, or just on the net cash flow of contributions and benefit payments, a little bit less than that. But that gives us a little over 26 months of safety reserve. So that's always had a good way to think about that. Also on this slide, just if you look at our global equity allocation, it's 24.9%, and fixed income is 29.1%. And the next slide, where we look at it on an adjusted basis, you'll see that those both go up. And what we're looking at on the adjusted basis, and we talked about at the last minute kind of some of the things we wanted to keep our eye on as we were working through volatile periods, was the potential downward pressure on private market assets that wouldn't flow through for several months or even till year end and beyond. And we want to keep that in mind with our, you know, kind of our allocation. So we're going to be having a couple views here. And so here you can see that the, you know, global equity, you know, which is near 25, is near 29 now, and fixed income is, you know, almost near 34%. So closer to target in that, just because of the denominator effect and lower assumed values for the private market assets. On the next slide, we just show performance. And you can see here we have the first quarter in the kind of first group of columns, and then we have quarter to date in kind of the second quarter, or April in the second group of columns, and then year to date. And one thing that's interesting here is kind of a good demonstration of downside protection and compounding. If you look at global equity, the excess return there was 64 basis points in the first quarter. You know, but in a big down market, just not down quite as much as the overall benchmark. And then in April, actually the relative performance was slightly worse, 82 basis points. But because, you know, we're of the size of those moves and the actual, so even though 82 basis points negative was more than 64, kind of when you put those together in a compounding picture, it still ended up without performance. So the other thing to note here is kind of the key global equity managers, you know, Boston Partners. We have two value managers in here, Boston Partners and Manulife. You know, Boston Partners has really been impacted by their value positioning over the last 18 months or so, and so if you book them against a value index, they're really kind of pretty much performing in line. And that same kind of issue is happening in Manulife, although we don't break them out, but that's happening as well. And some of the outperformance of the growth managers is also kind of related to their growth tilts. Those are the main things that are going on there. And then in fixed income, you can see in the first quarter we had, as we've talked about before, some pressure, especially from Brandywine, and that, a lot of that was driven by being an underweight to the U.S. dollar, and we're getting some of that back in the second quarter. I think that's the other thing to point out here is just on the Loomis Bank loans, recall that we're in the process of liquidating that, and so, that helped us. It's not really performance there. It's really more of the impact of kind of how much cash was in the portfolio at that time and when it was distributed. So, that shows high outperformance in that first quarter. And then you'll see that the actual performance numbers are small negatives. It's just what's going on kind of with the rest of the market there during that time. That's all I have there. Moving on to the next slide, which is impact statements, kind of, that's his slide 172, John. I'll call your attention at a top, kind of that top line of public markets. If you look at first quarter 2020, the kind of total impact was 153.4 million negative, and that's kind of dead on with what Brenda had. So this is just showing kind of we're tying very tightly to, we're coming at it from different angles, but they're kind of completely different perspectives, but we're really showing where our investment returns are coming and where that impact is. The other thing I'll show you on that top line is, that was negative 153 in the first quarter, and we got, more than a third of that back in the second, just in April. So we're up almost $60 million from public markets. And that's really, we have all the detail about what's driving the managers, and I don't think we need to go through that here. So that's all I have on that one. And then the next slide is investment initiatives, and just to briefly walk through some of this, you're always going to see this, liquidation of private market assets. We don't forget about it, even though we've talked about kind of, we expect it to be very difficult for the next few months because of where the markets are right now. That doesn't, reduce its importance to us. We're always thinking about how the managers are positioning those, and it remains our number one priority. The investment grade bond search continues. We complete our review of the proposals that we received. We've kept in touch with Makita and the investment advisory committee, and we've actually had interviews with two managers, and those same managers will interview with the IAC late in May, and then we're on track to make a board recommendation in June. Also, we've talked about before that we wanted to just evaluate our high yield product, and so we've gotten some proposals. We're both from Makita as well as some other managers we've been looking at on an informal basis just to see if we want to do something else there, and that will kind of guide us onto whether we want to do a more formal search in that area. We have spent a lot of time, Greg Earlbeck on Boston Partners and Mike Egan on Brandywine, kind of understand what's been going on there. And again, the key issues there is Boston Partners. They've really been before. Their philosophy and process is solid, and it's really been a value issue. Brandywine, the key driver for their underperformance has been their positioning on the dollar, and from a purchase power parity or PPP point of position, that's been driving underweight for quite a while. But in this kind of flight to safety environment, that has definitely worked against them. And as what we've seen in the past is that they tend to rebound after that kind of large drawdown. So, we're thinking about them kind of longer term, about that kind of currency positioning in the portfolio, but certainly in the near term, we understand what happens and we expect that to rebound some more. They're not falling apart. They're doing what we kind of, their behavior is consistent with their process and philosophy, so no immediate action needed there. Huff kind of, along with that top bullet point, Huff is our other big private equity fund, Lone Star and Huff, and we're also continuing to look at that. There's a lot of energy concentration in that fund, and so we're spending time there. You recall from several months ago, we wanted to look at our IMAs on a global basis to evaluates, you know, to make sure that we're including all of the and looking at all of the kind of key things that we should be looking at. And we've been condensing those and identifying those over the past few weeks. And then we'll take those to the IMA review. Makita, as Leo and I have had some dialogue regarding the IPS language for the safety reserve, and actually with also with the investment team, Josh and Kelly and the rest of the investment staff. And we initially had some language that was kind of would have plugged the hole, but it left us a little bit still on, I guess, not well defined in certain situations like we went through in the first quarter. And so Leo and Makita took a deeper look at it. And what we're evaluating right now is something that would kind of break the safety reserve out from the main portfolio and allocate it as a dollar amount and then reallocate the rest of the portfolio. We haven't finished our evaluation of that, but hopefully we'll have something for the next meeting. As we talked about in actuarial, there's this process we do of evaluating what we think the return expectations are going to be for the next 5 years, and we're also kind of fine-tuning that with Makita just to reevaluate after the downturn in the first quarter. Some other important things that we have on deck kind of that we'll get to just as soon as we can, public equity structure, review of securities lending, and then there were some former issues about kind of things that we could do for the board on the reporting format for Makita. Any questions on anything I covered as far as the portfolio update? And also, if anyone from the investment staff has anything I missed, then please speak up. Anyone from the board? Okay. That concludes my presentation. I'm sorry. There's one more slide, and it's kind of the lead-in. So on slide 174, this is our calendar review. So we go through the portfolio kind of bit by bit, and we will cover some real assets today, are smaller timber or small holdings in timber, as well as some our manager, Hearthstone. We'll move that over to closed session because a lot of that is very specific asset detail. So that's all I have. Sorry, false start there.
Okay, any other questions for Kent? Okay, thank you, Ken, very much. In order to try to make this a little efficient, be coming in and out of closed sessions, I've asked Kelly to do her executive director's report now before we do go into closed session on the real estate, Lone Star, and legal issues.
Okay, so on the executive director's report, item A, you have your typical newsletters that we provide as part of the agenda. Those are there. Open records update. We have one new open records item. As you might recall from the last board meeting, Governor Abbott has issued an order that open records requests do not have to be answered until offices reopen. But because this is extending longer than we originally anticipated and we're not getting a huge number of open records requests right now, I think we're able to manage this with our other workload, and I plan to go ahead and start responding to open records requests as we're getting them in our normal course. Most of those, as I said, can be done remotely. Occasionally, we may have to go in the office to pull some documents, but I think that will be okay. So what's outstanding right now is only 3 open records requests. 2 are from educational institutions, and 1 is from an actual member. And it's really that member one that I don't like having, that person continue to wait. So that's really why I'm making the change, is just to be able to respond to members more timely. So that's what we're doing on open records requests. Item C, just to update you on what the office is doing related to our COVID response. We continue to operate as we've discussed before. Everybody is working remotely. Occasionally, people go into the office as needed. Brenda had some people in the office to do some accounting work for the audit. They occasionally go in to do payroll for the pension payroll, print checks, those types of things. We have people go in to gather the mail and scan the mail. So as necessary, employees are going into the office, but we don't have a contingent of employees working all the time. right now both John and Damian are in the office, so we try to separate that. I anticipate that will continue until at least June 1st, probably longer. And what I'm doing to really gauge this reopening as it relates to the office is I tend to rely on the Dallas County risk assessment. And the reason I'm looking to Dallas County instead of the state is because, obviously, we're located in Dallas County. Most of our employees live in or near Dallas County as well as our members. So I think that that's a better gauge for the office than the statewide assessment at the statewide level. So we'll continue to monitor that. Currently, the county is saying, you know, it's still risky and people should work from home if they can. And I think we are doing everything we need to do. It might not be as efficient as we used to be, but we're able to continue our work as if we were in the office. So that's what we're doing at this point. Other than open records requests, the only thing I anticipate changing is I would like to change the way that the main phone line is working, but we're looking on exactly how that's going to work. So that may be a change which will enhance the service to the people calling in. Other than that, I expect things to continue as they are. We are working on how we will reconfigure the office. We are lucky that we have a lot of space in the office, so we only anticipate needing to move a few people once we are back in the office. We're looking at adding a partition in front of the receptionist and some other safety measures. So John has done a good job of kind of thinking ahead to get things in place and to order things that we might need for when we do open up. Are there any? Well, I guess we're not supposed to talk about questions, but if you have any concerns, please let me know after the meeting on ideas you might have related to what we can be doing differently from, you know, our COVID response. I have not received any complaints from members about not being able to get their needs met, so I think that's a good sign. And the last item I have on here is at the last board meeting, we had a member speak and ask that his retirement date be made retroactive back to when he was retirement eligible, even though he had not submitted his application. I sent a memo or an email to the trustees explaining the provisions of the plan and why we couldn't do that. So I just wanted to make sure you all saw that. And our plan is to just notify the member that, you know, our current decision is hasn't changed and his retirement date will be effective the date of his application. So with that, I don't have anything else for this item.
Anybody have questions to Kelly? Somebody
nope.
Saying something?
I said no.
Oh, okay. Thank you. These virtual meetings are sometimes difficult. We are now going to be going into the closed session for anybody who's out there. I mean, according to our schedule, we're going to be in closed session for an hour and a half or so since we've got a lot of items. When we come back, there could be an item that we just need to act on, at least one item, but it's nothing material, I don't believe, but people want to hang on, or I don't know, John, what any other process they can do? And then we got the supplemental meeting, which is very quick, so you're welcome to stay on the phone for an hour and a half, I guess, but it's up to you.
Yeah, I'm going to move everybody over to the waiting room, and then once we go back into the open session, I'll bring everybody back.
And send me a text if there are people hanging on, just so we know they're there. That would be helpful, John.
Okay.
Okay, very good. So with that, we will end the open session and go into closed session and start our review of real estate, Lone Star, and legal issues.